Hey, this is Brandy Rhodes, and you're listening to Salamonster Sounds Off.
A quick public service announcement. If you're going to hate someone, hate them with as much passion as Jim Ross hated Triple H.
It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered. I'm home.
You like fighting a woman?
You're saying Vince McMahon is stupid. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, my God. We're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
SmackDown sucks. It's almost as bad as Raw.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and fight me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Solo Monster, who are you to doubt El Dandy?
Welcome to episode 749 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, March 27th, 2022. I am the Solo Monster. We are less than 1 week away from WrestleMania 38. Obviously have a lot to say about that. The latest updates, where things stand with Seth Rollins, among other people, heading into the two-night WrestleMania next weekend. Of course, it was also the end of an era this week. The top story we heard for the first time in 6 months from Triple H after his cardiac scare. And we'll talk about that. NXT Stand and Deliver, also less than a week away. I'm going to have predictions for that show. And I did check out the first episode of the new WWE Evil series on Peacock. So I'm going to have some thoughts on that as well. A lot to get into this week. I want to say thank you to everybody who has been supporting the show as always. And if you would like to make a PayPal donation, you may do so on thesolomonster.com. You'll see the text link right there at the top of the page. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out. I want to say thank you to our PayPal producers, including awesome Anthony Anguiano. Anthony mentioned to me that a good friend of his, an old high school classmate, Vicky Hopkins, is celebrating a birthday this Wednesday. She's also running in the Boston Marathon this year for the American Foundation of Suicide Prevention. So I am sending a very happy birthday shout-out to Vicky, and congrats on meeting your goal. Best of luck in the marathon. Ms. Madness, Michelle Mills, the Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton, Night Stalker, Nayef Al-Safar, John Loose Cannon Lopez, Big B, Brian Becerra, Out of Control, Cody Thomas, Killshot, Keith Hart, the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eicher, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, Caleb Showtime Lindley. No apologies needed, brother. Thank you for the love. Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, Good Looks, Donnie Brooks, and Superkick, Shin Akuma from YouTube. There's a name I know some of you are going to recognize. Also, the Iowan Corn Farmer, Jesse Lampier. He's been a fan of the podcast for 9 years now and just signed up to become a Sound Up channel member on YouTube. Says he enjoys the Lost episodes, Better Call Saul Monster, and the live watch-along. So, Jesse, welcome to the family. And Joshua. Joshua has been a fan of the show since the early 100s. He has started a GoFundMe to help his friends with their mounting legal bills as it relates to their custody battle for their kids. If you'd like to read up more about it and help out, you may do so by going to GoFundMe.com and typing "help with legal costs for Samantha and Matt" into the search bar. He's trying to be a good friend and help out in any way that he can. So anything you think you can do, that is the place to go on GoFundMe.com. There's more shout-outs to come in a bit. So if you did not hear your name, fear not. Man, that lineup reads better than the lineup of the Andre Battle Royal on SmackDown this week. We have a better roster than they do. WrestleMania is less than a week away, and our friends at WrestleRumble.com are never one to disappoint this time of year, really any time of year. They've got two contests to tell you about, the first one being their WrestleMania Pick'em, offering $1,000 cold hard cash to the first place winner. Some questions you may need to answer include how many times will Brock Lesnar hit the F5 against Roman Reigns? How long will the match between Pat McAfee and Austin Theory go? Will any tables be broken during the match between Sami Zayn and Johnny Knoxville? And will the match between Charlotte Flair and Ronda Rousey end by pinfall or submission? So get those entries in before 8 p.m. Eastern on Saturday for your chance to win. That is also the same deadline for the Stone Cold Mania Championship Belt Contest. I'm going to be hosting the live drawing during my WrestleMania Saturday stream, picking four winners at random to win these cool-ass prizes. Fourth place winner receives a Stone Cold Mini Legacy Championship. Third place receives the Big Eagle Attitude Era Championship replica, the one you see over my shoulder, in fact, on, not that exact one, but that replica that you see on over my shoulder every single week on the streams. So that's the third place winner. Second place receives the WCW United States Championship replica. And the first place grand prize winner will receive a Smoking Skull Championship belt. And get this, it's only $1 to enter. That's it. So for $1, you can have the chance to win any of those four prizes, and you can enter as many times as you wish to increase your chances. Cutoff for entries is 8 p.m. Eastern on Saturday. Go to WrestleRumble.com to enter and tune into my WrestleMania post-show to see if you are a winner. We had some fun this week for the channel members on YouTube. We did do our second live watch-along on Wednesday, the 25 years to the day anniversary, I guess you would say, of the Bret Hart-Steve Austin submission match at WrestleMania 13, one of the best matches of all time. That is up in the archives if you are a channel member. And Sound Off Gamer is back. First installment in a long-ass time as I dove into 2K22. I couldn't pin anybody with my Nintendo Switch Pro controller playing on PC, so that was a bit of a problem. However, I am now using a PS5. Controller with the PC version, and it runs just fine. I can actually pin people, so now hopefully I can actually start winning some matches. So there will be more Sound of Gamer. I'm going to be jumping into my Rise mode very soon. A quick note, there is an Amazon affiliate link in the video description of that first gamer, and I'll put it in the next one too. If you use it to buy a copy of 2K22, the podcast gets a little kickback. So if you're thinking about buying the game, get it through Amazon and use our link. And as an aside, AEW, as I know many of you are aware of, they are working on their own console video game. I'm guessing it won't be out until sometime next year. But it is supposed to be out on all platforms, including PC. So we'll do more gamers with the AEW game when it drops. And this week, we got a peek at what the name of the game is likely going to be. Last Monday, AEW filed to trademark the name AEW Fight Forever. For use with, quote, downloadable game software, end quote. So that gives us a pretty good insight, I think, into what the name of that game is going to be. So I can't wait to play it and see how it compares to 2K22. On March 24th, 1992, Triple H had his very first professional wrestling match. And almost to the day, 30 years later, on March 25th, 2022... Triple H announced his retirement from the ring. More than 6 months had passed since WWE issued a statement saying that Paul Levesque had undergone a successful procedure following what they described only as a cardiac event. They were very vague about it. They said the episode was caused by a genetic heart issue and he is expected to make a full recovery. And since that time, there have been no further updates on his health. Lot of speculation, but no further updates. He has not been seen on television, even on social media. He wasn't exactly terribly active. You know, here and there he would post stuff and retweet stuff. But they, you know, tore down the NXT brand that he created and took it in a totally different direction. They got rid of a lot of the people on his team who used to work for him and fired them, among many, many other people. And without knowing for sure, it just felt like this cardiac event that they described was probably a lot more serious than they were letting on. Because it didn't seem like they were expecting him back in his old role anytime soon. On Friday, he broke his silence in an interview on ESPN with Stephen A. Smith, So he may never wrestle again, but he still knows how to get heel heat by forcing me to sit through a Stephen A. Smith interview. As it turns out, it was a lot more serious than anybody could have imagined. He said that around SummerSlam time last year, he was very busy doing a lot of different things, and they were having tryout camps. I know they had at least one out there in Vegas, and you know, he had his hands and his tentacles in a lot of different things, and he started to feel very run down. He was starting to feel sick, and he thought that he had COVID. He said that he had COVID before, and he was experiencing similar symptoms, but when he got tested, he was negative for the virus. And instead, he was diagnosed with viral pneumonia, which got progressively worse to the point that Stephanie noticed that he was coughing up blood. Kind of a problem if you start coughing up blood. And when he went to go get checked out, they found fluid in his lungs and around his heart. The tests showed that his ejection fraction, which measures the percentage of blood leaving your heart each time it squeezes. Now, basically, it's a measurement of how well your heart pumps blood with each beat. His fraction was 30. In a normal, healthy person, it should be in the 55 to 60 range. So that was not a good sign. And so when he got the text message about that from one of his doctors, they told him, pack a bag and get to the emergency room. I'll fill you in on the way. By the time he got there, his ejection fraction was down to 22, and he was officially in heart failure. As he says, he was in heart failure bad. And by the next morning, his fraction had plunged to 12, just as he was going in for a heart cath procedure. And he said, I was nosediving and at the 1 yard line of where you don't want to be for your family and your future. He said when they got inside, he had genetically a 99% blockage in his left anterior descending artery, which is what they call the widowmaker. His heart had started to create a secondary pathway, but that was also clogged. So basically, he was a dead man walking and didn't even know it. He was moments away. If he had a clot or if he had any type of thickening, he was a goner. That was it. Lights out. That's how close he was to death. He said his father had a triple bypass at age 62. He said his grandfather died at 70 from heart disease. But what he did not know was that his great-grandfather died suddenly at 52. So you see a pattern developing here. It was a genetic issue. And when Stephen A. pressed him on, you know, even knowing his family history, you know, did you ever suspect that something like this might happen? You know, Triple H, he praised the WWE wellness program. He said he was checked all the time. He never had high blood pressure. He never had high cholesterol. He did say that he had what he referred to as an athletic heart, which he said is a common thing in a lot of athletes, and that his heart did show some enlargement. But there were never any issues, and it all came out of nowhere. He got emotional talking about his three girls, who range in age from 11 to 15, and he said there were moments where they were putting him under for anesthesia for various procedures, and he wasn't sure if he'd ever wake up again. And that's a tough pill to swallow. And when asked what the future holds for him, he said, as far as in-ring, he's done. He will never wrestle again. WWE had this all queued up. Because as soon as he made the announcement, out went the press release, out went the announcement on WWE.com that Triple H has officially retired from in-ring competition. He says he's done in no uncertain terms. He says, I'm done. He says now he has a defibrillator in his chest. You know, Scott Hall had one in his chest as well. He had a pacemaker too. But he joked, he goes, it probably wouldn't be a good idea to get zapped on live TV. And, you know, when it comes to stuff like that, you can't take bumps, or you're not supposed to, because the wiring can be knocked loose and all of a sudden this thing isn't working the way it's supposed to and you don't know it. And then the day comes that you need, you know, to get shocked or zapped or whatever and the thing doesn't work and then you're dead. I can't imagine that WWE would even consider clearing him for any kind of physical contact, bumps or anything like that. So, yeah, again, it may not be something he wants, but I do believe he's done. When he says he's done, he's done. I'm sure they've told him, you're done. He did reveal that he had previously talked to Vince McMahon last year about plans for him to get back in the ring at WrestleMania this year in Dallas. they had a plan. They had an opponent in mind, but then all of this happened, and that plan obviously went out the window. And immediately, people online started throwing Cody's name around. Oh, it must have been Triple H against Cody. There was no Cody in WWE. That wasn't a thing when those two came up with whatever opponent they were going to come up with. If they were having conversations last summer about Triple H doing something in Dallas, Cody Rhodes was not part of that conversation at all. Unless Cody Rhodes had some kind of pre-existing plan in place, secret plan with WWE that he was going to go there when his contract ran out. No, it wasn't Cody. Honestly, the first name I thought of was AJ Styles. AJ has made no bones about the fact that he wanted to work a match with Triple H. He would pester him about it. So I wouldn't be surprised if that was the idea they had in mind. Only he and Vince McMahon know for sure what the plan was. But he said he's been back in the office for a while now. He's had to step back a bit, though, and he's still in recovery. His endurance is not what it used to be before. Right now, he says he's focused on recruiting talent, and he put over Gable Steveson, who just won his second NCAA wrestling title, and he retired from the sport. He's going to be making an appearance at WrestleMania next weekend, and then he's going to be on Monday Night Raw very soon. If you remember, Steveson was the last name drafted to the Raw brand in last year's draft. So he's going to Raw in the next, probably in the next couple of months, we'll start seeing him on Raw. But hearing him talk about how close he came to instant death is very scary. It's a very scary thing. This man is in heart failure. I mean, just because he's doing better now than he was 6 months ago does not mean that he isn't still suffering from heart failure. He very likely is still considered to be in heart failure. Now, we don't know what his heart measurement is at this exact moment relative to what it was before. You know, he talked about it being 30 and then 22 and then 12. I can't imagine it's 12 or 22 anymore, but is it considered normal? Is he back in a safe zone? We don't know. It could still be low enough to constitute heart failure. You know, we all remember the Ultimate Warrior. The Ultimate Warrior came back, he went into the Hall of Fame, and then he showed up at WrestleMania the night after that, and then he cut that promo on Raw the following night after that. And then he dropped dead of a massive heart attack the very next day. It was a very bizarre sequence of events. But you go back and you listen to the Warrior and his words in that promo on Raw, and how could you not come away from that thinking that in some way, even subconsciously, if not very consciously, this man had some kind of feeling or premonition that he wasn't long for this earth when he said what he said on that show. It was a very weird weekend. But we all remember that. Triple H helped bring the Warrior back together with Vince McMahon. And, you know, things like that are going to be part of his legacy as well. In terms of him in a suit behind the scenes working as an executive in WWE. Him bringing people like the Warrior and like Bruno Sammartino back into the fold. And mending those fences, which never would have happened were it not for Triple H. I remember, you know, Triple H going to Vince and saying, hey, what about Bruno? And Vince was like, good luck with that. You want to try, you want to waste your time, go ahead. And he managed to pull it off. And all these guys now, Bruno, Warrior, they're gone. But at least they were able to mend those fences first. And I think that is part of the legacy also that Triple H has in this company. As much as anything he ever did in the ring is him being able to, you know, facilitate things like that. But like Triple H, the Warrior had a family history of heart disease. His father and his grandfather both died from it in their mid-50s. And he knew he would die young. He told people around him that he thought he would, especially after all the steroids he took. And he told them he had no regrets. Because without them, without the roids and everything he did, there would not have been an Ultimate Warrior. And to me, you know, I hear this and it boggles the mind that somebody would be aware of their family history of heart problems and would still choose to pump their body full of stuff that they have to know is going to take years off their life. I mean, we may as well address the elephant in the room. Dumbo, he's off over there in the corner. You can't miss him. I've been getting questions about this since Friday. Asking about Triple H and steroids and people. Some people saying, well, it's his own fault. First of all, he did have a genetic condition. So I think it's a little simplistic to attribute this to, you know, steroid use or just steroid use. But did it help? You know, whatever substances he may have been using over the years, did it help? Of course not. And knowing that you have a family history of heart problems, as he knew, and still choosing to do that stuff is a risk that he chose to take. You know, we all make choices in life. But I do think there is a little something called empathy that more people should probably have in situations like this. When you hear that the man, you know, he's talking about this and he almost broke down talking about his kids. You know, I feel bad for them having to see their father go through something like that. You know, more important than any wrestling match, this man is just lucky to be alive and to be able to be with his family. You know, you work your whole life, you climb the ladder, you accumulate all this wealth, as he has. You live in a nice house or houses, you start a family. And for what? To turn around and drop dead one day? Work yourself to the bone, go home, and then, you know, keel over face first on the floor? At 52? Because that's what almost happened to him. At some point, you need to stop and smell the roses and enjoy the fruits of your labor, and the man has earned the right to do that. He doesn't have anything left to prove in the ring. The last official match of record of Triple H's career will go down as a tag team match in Tokyo, Japan, teaming with Shinsuke Nakamura against Samoa Joe and Bobby Roode. And it just feels right that his last two televised matches were against Dave Batista at WrestleMania 35 and Randy Orton a few months later in Saudi Arabia at Super Showdown, the two men that he personally handpicked and groomed for Evolution. Now, he did have a fight with Orton on Raw in the Thunderdome last year, but that technically wasn't a match. I don't even think they had a referee out there for it. That was just a shitty Fiend angle with Alexa Bliss where the lights went out and Triple H vanished. We never saw him again. And then she shot a fireball at Orton's face, and we ended up with Lucha Orton in a mask for 2 weeks because of his severe burns, which magically healed in record time. The truth of the matter is this. Triple H's best days in the ring were long behind him. It has been years since he has had a truly enjoyable match. Most of his stuff in recent, not all of it, but most of his stuff in recent years was very plodding, very boring, and it would go half an hour because he had it in his head that his matches had to go that long, when really they didn't. They didn't have to go that long. The last truly great match of Triple H's career was WrestleMania 34, where he teamed with Stephanie against Kurt Angle and Ronda Rousey. That was in Ronda's debut. That was an excellent match. It was the match of the night. So much fun. But after that, his best days were behind him. So even though his career may not have ended on his terms the way that he wanted it to, I mean, look, nobody ever wants to be told that their career is over. They want to be able to write their own ending. Not everybody gets to do that. Undertaker was able to do that with the Boneyard match. Shawn Michaels was able to do that at WrestleMania 26. But Stone Cold didn't. One of the biggest stars of all time, he didn't. Hulk Hogan, another one of the biggest stars of all time. He'd still be wrestling now if he hadn't had 10 back surgeries. He didn't get to write his own ending. Kurt Angle didn't. You think he wanted to work with Baron Corbin at WrestleMania in his last match? He wanted to work with John Cena. But Triple H should have no regrets about the career that he had. 24 championships, including 14 world titles, a two-time Royal Rumble winner, King of the Ring winner, multiple-time WrestleMania headliner, in the Hall of Fame as a member of DX, and he'll get his own solo induction in the next few years. That goes without saying. I mean, hell, he could probably end up going into the Hall of Fame, the first three-time Hall of Famer. He can go, he's in as a member of DX. He can go in as a solo inductee for his career alone, and when all is said and done, he could go in as an executive. Wouldn't shock me. He becomes the first three-time Hall of Famer at some point. But, you know, in his in-ring career, he was never the guy. And I talked about this for the first time years ago. I said he was never the guy. He was always the guy who worked with the guy. But he got to work with them all. His career spanned multiple eras of WWE, the New Generation era, the Attitude era, the Ruthless Aggression era, the PG era, the Reality era, right on up to the Modern era. The one thing, honestly, that I'm surprised he never did was work a match in NXT. Like a big takeover match against one of his chosen rising stars that he could put over. He never did that. I never saw Triple H as a main event talent until the street fight with Cactus Jack at the Royal Rumble in 2000. That opened my eyes to Triple H as a top heel in the company. Up to that point, you know, he had a few main events late in 99. You knew they were trying. They were trying to make him. They started the McMahon-Helmsley regime stuff, but then came the match with Foley, and Mick Foley did more for Triple H's career than any other single talent, save, I would say, for one, and that would be China. Because putting China together with Triple H was a game changer for Triple H in his career. But as far as working in the ring, and their storylines and feuds on TV, nobody did more for Triple H than Mick Foley. For me, that street fight is when he truly arrived. And I've said this before, Triple H in the year 2000, from January on, is my all-time favorite period of Triple H's career. Physically, the man was at his peak. This was pre-quad tear, the first one. You know, his work in the ring was excellent. That is my favorite era of Triple H. He was a tremendous heel. And he and The Rock together, those two carried that company while Steve Austin was out recovering from his spinal fusion. When I think of Triple H's career, and I don't want to make it sound like I'm eulogizing the man, but since his wrestling career is done, I think it's appropriate to talk about this. I think of the pairing with China. I think of the birth of D-Generation X and how jarring it was for him overnight to go from the Greenwich snob to pointing at his crotch, telling people to suck it. That was quite the sudden character shift. I think of the new DX, the second version of DX, when he took over as the leader after WrestleMania 14. That is my favorite version of DX. I think that is the best version of DX. Better than the original. I think all of the matches that he had with The Rock, you know, I think of those matches, his greatest rival in the ring, The Rock, the ladder match at SummerSlam, where he injured his knee, pretty serious knee injury, still finished the match, won the title, and then had to vacate it, but, you know, finished the match, and what a tremendous match it was. Their backlash match, when Stone Cold came back and laid everybody out with a chair. Their Iron Man match. At Judgment Day, still my favorite Iron Man match of all time. Of all the 60-minute matches they've done in that company, you know, Iron Man style, that one remains my favorite. I think of the Love Triangle storyline with Kurt Angle and Stephanie, how entertaining it was and what a shitty, abrupt ending it had. I think of the two-man power trip and the quad tear on Raw, where again, he finished the match on one leg. Then there's the comeback in Madison Square Garden in 2002, one of the loudest ovations of all time. The angle, years later, where he kicked Randy Orton out of Evolution. Right, that's a very memorable angle. I think of his Reign of Terror. Can't think of Triple H without thinking about the Reign of Terror. In the dark days of Monday Night Raw, little did I know there would be even darker days ahead. I didn't know how good I had it back then. The Katie Vick angle and him fucking a corpse. What he did to Booker T at WrestleMania. I think of the famous Am I Fucking Going Over story that one of the writers told. Famous story. Him beating CM Punk when Punk was the hottest thing in that company in 2011. Even if it did take three pedigrees, it never should have happened. Beating Sting at WrestleMania, which was inexcusable. But also putting Batista over in three straight pay-per-view main events and cementing him as a top guy. The authority angle, which did no favors to people like Dolph Ziggler and, you know, Ryback. But in the end, he put over Daniel Bryan in the strongest possible way. Daniel Bryan didn't need Triple H to put him over the way he did. He was already the biggest thing in the company at the time. But in the end, he did the right thing, and he put Daniel Bryan over in the strongest possible way, even if it only happened because his WrestleMania match with Punk fell through when Punk walked out on the company. But his greatest legacy is what he created with NXT and the talent that he worked with and brought in and worked with to try to help them, the talent he signed. He basically raided Ring of Honor of all of its key talent and took them for himself to create his own super indie. He had these plans for world domination. They were going to open performance centers in all these different countries, and you're going to have, you know, we have NXT UK, and we were going to have NXT Japan, and we probably would have had NXT Australia, and, you know, maybe Canada, and all these different places, all these different ideas that he had. But he took all this talent, created his own super indie. You know, he brought in names like Samoa Joe, who WWE had no interest in for so many years. Physically, he didn't fit what they were looking for. So we missed Joe in his prime physical years. By the time he got to WWE, even then in 2015, he was no longer in his physical prime or physical peak. He had racked up a lot of mileage, a lot of injuries. But he brought in Joe. He brought in Finn Balor, Kevin Owens, Sami Zayn, Adrian Neville, Shinsuke Nakamura, Adam Cole, Johnny Gargano, Tommaso Ciampa, American Alpha. You know, the women's division he put together down there with Charlotte Flair, Sasha Banks, Becky Lynch, Bayley, Asuka, Paige, Shayna Baszler, Rhea Ripley. That era of the black and gold was the best television that WWE has produced, really. I mean, if you think about that whole period, and we're probably talking about a good 5 or 6 year period, really. 6 or 7 year period. It was the best television most of that period that WWE was putting on. NXT became my favorite show of the week. Sasha Banks against Bayley in Brooklyn. Johnny Gargano against Andrade Cien Almas in Philadelphia. Adam Cole against Johnny Gargano, WrestleMania weekend in New York. Incredible matches. Some of the best matches of the last decade. All of which came under Triple H's vision of what he wanted NXT to be. And for that, I owe him thanks. He may not be involved with NXT anymore, but if he has a hand in recruiting and grooming the stars of tomorrow, I can only hope that whatever good he did for the people during that black and gold era, he can do the same for those people as well. He got it right. More often than not, he got it right with NXT. And I had a level of faith in him and the people writing for him and working under him. Kind of the same way I felt about Lucha Underground. You know, I very much enjoyed Lucha Underground. Did I agree and like every single thing that they did? No. But by and large, they were trying to tell stories in a very exaggerated way with exaggerated characters. But they were telling these stories. I had faith and trust in the writers of that show to do the right thing, have things, you know, make enough sense where I didn't have to worry, like, what the fuck are these people doing? The way that I think about Raw and SmackDown when I watch it every single week. And that's the way I felt about NXT. I put my faith and trust in what they were doing because more often than not, they delivered. And they gave that audience who liked that product exactly the kind of wrestling and the kind of show that they were looking for. And that made it enjoyable. That made it fun. He gave them, the talent there, a level of creative freedom, if you listen to them talk about it, a level of creative freedom that was, you know, taken away from them in a lot of cases when they hit the main roster. Some of them survived the call-up, many of them did not. So often, you know, they undermine these people and change things about them that worked, and they ignore everything they did in NXT before hitting Raw and SmackDown. I can only imagine the frustration that Triple H must have felt every single time. You know, he would see one of these talents get stripped of their name or their identity the moment they would get called up, or get called up and then flounder because they didn't have any ideas on what to do with them. Or called up and then weeks later, cut for no reason. Budget cuts. Time and time again. And then to see everything you've created just blown up while you sit at home, convalescing from this near-death experience. I don't feel bad for Triple H as much as I do the talents themselves, who constantly get fucked over. But I can completely understand the frustration he probably feels whenever he sees something like that happen. But that black and gold brand is a major part of his legacy. And look, it got them 2 more hours of television time on USA Network. You know, I sometimes hear the question asked, would Triple H have gotten as far as he did in his career? Would he be in the position he's in now without marrying into the McMahon family? And the answer is no. He would not have landed an executive role. He would not have been placed in the position of power that he was at the Performance Center and running NXT. No other star from the Attitude Era went on to do anything like that for the company. How many of those Attitude Era stars from his era back then have gone on to land big cushy corporate gigs in WWE? Nobody. So of course, yes, marrying the boss's daughter had its benefits. But I don't think he would have been any less of a major star and a Hall of Famer had he not married Stephanie. I think it is unfair to say that the only reason Triple H went on to become a big name and a big star in the ring and his career is because he married Stephanie McMahon. That I don't necessarily agree with. All the other stuff, absolutely, that's the only reason that happened. And he's in the position he's in. But I think it's unfair to say, well, the only reason he's a big star is because of that. You got to understand something. He would have gone on to have a very long, successful career. Because one thing that we have seen over these last 2 decades is that Vince McMahon likes his stars. And there aren't very many of them left anymore. Triple H was a star from the most popular era in the history of the company. They may be making more money now because they found all these other ways to make money and these TV contracts. But the product now is by no means as white-hot and popular as it was back then. He was part of that era. So he will always have had value to Vince McMahon because it is a star-driven company. I mean, look at WrestleMania this year. Pat McAfee in the ring, Logan Paul, Johnny Knoxville, bringing back Stone Cold Steve Austin. You don't think this isn't a star-driven company? I've said that before. There are a bunch of star fuckers in this company. They love it. They love the attention. But all those stars, Undertaker now is retired, Chris Jericho left the company. There aren't as many of them left. They're almost completely gone. Or retired. So yes, he would have had plenty of success for that reason alone, if nothing else. Because Vince McMahon needs his stars. And now that his in-ring career is over, if you're looking for some Triple H matches to go back and watch, I put a little list together. Very informal list, nothing ranked or anything. Here's a bunch that I think are worth watching and worth going out of your way to see. I mentioned earlier the ladder match with The Rock at SummerSlam 98. A great match. The Royal Rumble street fight with Cactus Jack. Truly one of his best matches. The 10-man tag on Raw. The month after that, February of 2000. Triple H and the Radicals against The Rock, Cactus Jack, Rikishi, and Too Cool. One of my all-time favorite matches in Monday Night Raw history. The Iron Man match at Judgment Day with The Rock. The Last Man Standing match that he had with Chris Jericho at Fully Loaded 2000, which is, I think, is still their best match. I also quite enjoyed their Raw match before Backlash that year, where Jericho won the title. The Phantom title change. Jericho beat Triple H to win the title on the fast count by Earl Hebner. Place went nuts. I think they were in State College, Pennsylvania that night. Only in the next segment for Triple H to have Earl Hebner reverse the decision. That entire first, like, 30 or 40 minutes of the show is still one of the best openings to Raw, I think, in the history of the show. The Three Stages of Hell match he had with Steve Austin in No Way Out in 2001. WrestleMania 17 against The Undertaker. Doesn't get talked about nearly as much as their later WrestleMania matches are, but it should be. And the WrestleMania match they had in Atlanta at 27, 10 years after the one at X7. That was an excellent match as well. I know people also talk about the end of an era thing in the Hell in a Cell. I didn't like that match as much as I like the other ones, but it does have that great near fall. The most convincing near fall we've ever had, that the streak might just end. when Shawn Michaels, as the referee, super kicked Undertaker right into a pedigree. That was a great time. I was in the stadium that night. That was my first Mania live. And everybody fell for it. Everybody went nuts for that spot. The two-man power trip against Jericho and Benoit on Raw for the tag team titles. That was the night Triple H tore his quad. A classic match. Too bad that it will never be talked about. They'll never show any kind of a highlights package. It won't be part of his Hall of Fame video or anything, but so that's unfortunate, but that was a tremendous match. The street fight with Shawn Michaels when Shawn came back after all, you know, 4 years gone, SummerSlam 2002. The first Elimination Chamber match. He was a very big part of that match. He put Shawn Michaels over, who won the world title from him in Madison Square Garden. WrestleMania 20, triple threat. Shawn Michaels, Chris Benoit, Triple H. And the sight of Triple H tapping out at the end of that show. Again, a bittersweet moment to go back and watch now, but no less of an excellent match. The opener at WrestleMania 30 in New Orleans against Daniel Bryan. Also, excellent match. The two Evolution matches. When Evolution reformed in 2014, they took on The Shield in two pay-per-views, Payback and Extreme Rules. I think Payback was the one we got Blutista, which very much upset him. I remember him being very upset about that. I think he's still upset about that. I come back, we have this great match, and all you people want to talk about is that I wore blue. Like, he didn't understand. He really was greatly offended by this. But both of those matches, they put The Shield over strong. Those were two tremendous matches. You know, there was a stretch of a few months there in the first half of 2014 that I think was Triple H's best in-ring work in many, many years. And then there's the mixed tag from WrestleMania 34. It was him and Stephanie against Kurt Angle and Ronda Rousey. You can tell from this list here that there's way more in there from the earlier years. I think of Triple H more as a bottom-heavy guy than a top-heavy guy in terms of the weight of his career and which part of his career I kind of weigh more as far as the higher caliber of matches. But that's a pretty strong list, I think, for you to dive into. And by the way, since so many people have asked me, I'll keep this short. Yes, I saw Ryback's tweet about Triple H, and no, I am not talking about it beyond that, because that's exactly what he wants. His name was trending. I mean, he must have been over the moon to see his name trending, because why the hell else would Ryback's name be trending? Why else would his name be trending? Unless there was some kind of an incident or he died, there's no other reason for Ryback's name to ever be trending. It's the only reason he tweeted anything at all, to seek attention. Ryback has nachos for brains. Let him dip his head in cheese and shout into the void. I did say I would circle back around to the additional shout-outs, and I do want to shout-out New York punk Arnold Modesto for his PayPal support this week, as well as John Raging Mad Riffle, the Wichita Workhorse Clayton Nettleton, Sherrod Big Daddy Boyd, and Jessica, too. I hope you're doing well. The Pastor of Pain, Damian Yule, Razor's Edge, Robert Fox, and Casey is Raw. And also don't want to forget Poetry in Motion, Isaac Fox. Check out his website at Isaac Fox, that's FOXX.com, where he sells poetry and original paintings. He also creates custom paintings as well. He's got some really colorful stuff on there. So check it out, IsaacFox.com. Again, that is IsaacFoxx.com. New Japan Pro Wrestling crowned a winner in its 2022 New Japan Cup tournament earlier this morning. If you do not want to be spoiled because you haven't watched it yet, skip ahead by about 90 seconds. The winner of this year's New Japan Cup is Zack Sabre Jr. He defeated Tetsuya Naito in the finals. And in his post-match scrum, he credited his win to George Michael, who he spoke to in a hallucination that he said was likely brought on by his concussed brain. This is the second time that he has blacked out and had George Michael give him advice on what finish to use in a match. Last time, earlier in the tournament, he told him to use the techers to beat Will Ospreay. This time, he said George Michael was playing tennis with Prince when he interrupted him. And he told him to use the Saber Driver to win his match against Naito, and he did. So he dedicated his win to George Michael. Will Ospreay, Shingo Takagi, and Tetsuya Naito were the main names that he beat in this tournament. This is his second New Japan Cup victory. He last won the cup in 2018. I heard great things about Sabre and Ospreay, but also Sabre and Shingo, and Okada and Naito. So it sounds like I have some catching up to do. Big E tweeted this week that he had his first doctor's appointment since leaving the hospital after getting his neck broken, and it was sobering to be told that because of his C1 fracture, he narrowly escaped a stroke, paralysis, or death. He says, life feels even more precious and valuable now. I'll bet it does. After something like that, how could it not? I honestly wonder if he ever comes back, or if it would even be smart for him to get back in the ring. You know, Tyson Kidd had his C1 and C2 fused after his injury, where he almost died. You know, same thing. He almost lost his life. 95% of the people who suffer the same injury that he did end up dead or paralyzed for the rest of their lives. So it is nothing short of a miracle that he's walking around today, but he never wrestled again either. You know, Mitsuharu Misawa, he died in the ring suffering a C1 fracture. I think the way it was described with him was an internal decapitation. But that was something that, you know, built up over a period of time. This sort of injury, you know, the C1 and all that, that's no joke. That's very, very serious. And I'm sure he's going to try to come back. He's going to use that as motivation. I hope he can. I hope he can. I'm not, you know, hoping that, you know, he never wrestles again. I'm just saying, I don't think people should necessarily assume that, well, he'll just take a year or whatever, and then he'll come back like so many other wrestlers who had spinal fusion and had all these neck injuries, and Austin and Benoit and Lita and Rhino and all these different people. I don't know. You know, it's very different, the kind of injury that he sustained. But, you know, if anybody can do it, you know, he's got a neck as thick as an ox. If anybody can do it, it's Big E. The WWE Hall of Fame ceremony is less than a week away, and we only have The Undertaker, Vader, and Charmel as the confirmed inductees for 2022. So let's see, they have their big legend, they have their posthumous inductee, they have more than one, they have their female inductee, they need a tag team. So maybe we get the announcement this week of the Steiner Brothers, possibly, going into the Hall of Fame. But we did learn the name of this year's Warrior Award recipient, and I cannot think of a more deserving name than Shad Gaspard, who died 2 years ago making the ultimate sacrifice for his son. He and his son were at the beach. They were in the water. They got caught up in a strong rip current, you know, while they were swimming. 8-foot-tall waves just crashing down on them. And when the lifeguards made their way out to save him, his final words were, "Save my son." And I think he may have actually physically thrown his son at them so he can get closer. But he told them in no uncertain terms, "Save my son." And they did. Unfortunately, they couldn't save Shad. By the time they looked back, he was gone. He was washed out at sea. 39 years old. The man died a hero. He gave his own life to save that of his son. And his son, as well as his widow, are both going to be there to accept the award on his behalf. So there will not be a dry eye in the house. I'm getting all emotional right now just thinking about it. It's not going to be a dry eye in the house on Friday. That's going to be a tough one, but a well-deserved honor, and I'm very glad they're doing something special to acknowledge him. The men's and women's Owen Hart Cup tournaments are about to get underway soon, and the first qualifier for the Women's Cup takes place on AEW Dynamite this Wednesday. The Bunny will be hopping on into Dynamite to take on a new mystery signing that will be announced by Tony Khan this week. I see a lot of chatter on social media about Tony Storm's 90-day non-compete expiring this Tuesday. I haven't seen that confirmed anywhere. You know, I know that she walked out on the company. Did they actually formally give her release? It looks like it, because she's doing things. She's got, you know, all these different signings now that she's starting to book and get out there and do. And she wouldn't be able to do all of the things that she's doing now and about to do, I think, if she hadn't gotten her release technically from WWE. So, you know, if that's the case, she probably is working under a 90-day non-compete. The question is, does it expire on Tuesday? That I have not seen confirmed anywhere. But Toni Storm is my prediction. I think it is going to be Toni Storm. Not that she needs the money, You know, she just opened up an OnlyFans. She made $30,000 in one day. Imagine what she'll make in a month. Remember, though, just because they bring somebody in for the Owen doesn't necessarily mean they're in full time. It is possible that Tony Khan brings people in just for the tournament, even without a full-time deal. So until we get the graphic that says Tony Storm is All Elite, it is not official. It is never official in AEW until we get the graphic. If you've been hoping to see The Big Show back on AEW television reprising a bit part that he had in a movie from 24 years ago, then this is the best news you're going to hear all week. In an appearance on The Rob Brown Show, Paul White revealed that Tony Khan has secured the rights to the Captain Insano character from The Waterboy. Nearly a year after AEW filed to trademark the name. Hat tip to Wrestling Inc. for the quotes. He said, Tony Khan and I have some pretty fun stuff coming up in the future that him and I have put together. Captain Insano will be coming out in the next couple of months, so that's why I've kind of toned down a little on the in-ring performing as well. He's toned down. He's had one fucking match. How many months ago was that, toned down? Because I'm getting a wardrobe together now for the outfits. Max Dunbar, who is an incredible comic book design guy, helped draw the outfit up for Captain Insano. We're getting that made now, and before you know it, Captain Insano is going to be running wild in AEW, dude. Hopefully the fans will be excited about him. For me, it's just a chance to have fun and really apply a different character. The Captain Insano character is just going to have a lot more energy, a lot more enthusiasm from A to Z. So definitely, when Captain Insano hits the scene, the party is going to be lit. To steal a word from the younger generation, I'm looking to have a lot of fun. I've got a luxurious cape as well, so I am super excited. Well, look, I mean, things are always more exciting when you're wearing a cape. I don't know why Kane ever ditched his when he first debuted. I'm wearing a cape as we speak, as I sit here and record this show. I have my Solomonster cape that I'm wearing. It's going to be weird seeing Captain Insano without any hair, though. But you know what? I guess 24 years later, I guess it only makes sense. You know, he'd have more hair coming out of his ears and his nose than he would the top of his head. Tony Khan is really going crazy, isn't he, with all these signings? All the names that he's brought in. Teasing another one this week in the women's tournament, and now we're even getting Captain Insano. And the last thing I expected to see on my television this week was J.J. Dillon and Kevin Sullivan in court with Steve Harvey as the presiding judge. But it's those little surprises that sometimes bring me the most joy. This gives new meaning to wrestler's court. My first question was, when the fuck did Steve Harvey get his law degree? And the answer is, he didn't. The show is described as an unscripted comedy series. ABC still has not said if any of these verdicts on the show will actually be legally binding. But according to the show's casting website, all judgments are paid by production. So as opposed to the defendant, let's say, loses the case against them, they have to pay the award directly to the plaintiff, like in a real court. Instead of that, the show pays for it. But these are real cases. These are real lawsuits that people are bringing against each other. This was the case of Jim Morrison against Kevin Sullivan. So not only was I today years old when I learned that Steve Harvey was now a judge, I also had no idea that J.J. Dillon's real name was Jim Morrison. That's fantastic. That is fantastic. Dillon was suing his friend of 40 years for a $7,500 loan that J.J. gave to Kevin 5 years ago to buy a boat. They were at some wrestling convention together, and they were talking, and Sullivan really wanted to buy this boat. It was a $15,000 boat. He had half the money. And Dillon said, I'll give you the other half. They talked about maybe installments, and J.J. was like, nope, just, you know, you pay me back when you have the whole thing. Here you go. Here's the $7,500. I have the money. Pay me back the whole thing when you have it. Sullivan's contention is that they never agreed on a due date for him to pay the loan back. He said Dillon told him he could pay him back whenever, which led to an incredible moment where the Taskmaster read from the dictionary. This was an amazing sight. You have to picture this. Here's Steve Harvey sitting as a judge before J.J. Dillon and Kevin Sullivan, and the taskmaster is reading from the dictionary the definition of the word whenever. Whenever, he said, means no specific amount of time. Well, fuck me, I didn't know that. I just learned something new. I think they could shop around the new television series to all the networks. The Taskmaster reads the dictionary. I'd watch that. Once JJ mentioned that they both came from the world of professional wrestling, Steve Harvey lit up like a Christmas tree. And he talked about how he's been a wrestling fan since he was a little boy, and he used to watch Bobo Brazil and the Iron Sheik. In the end, Judge Harvey ended up ruling in favor of Dillon for the $7,500 he sued for, but he said that because of the bond that these two men shared and the joy brought to millions of people by these two men over the years, he said the court would pay the money. And everybody cheered, and of course the litigants, they were amazed by this development. And then Dillon and Sullivan hugged it out, and they posed for a photo with Steve Harvey while JJ threw up the four fingers. I was hoping it would end with Dillon turning to him and saying, "I respect you, Booker man." I was left bitterly disappointed that that didn't happen. But at least the story had a happy ending. Seth Rollins isn't very happy. He's still searching for that elusive WrestleMania match. And Stone Cold Kevin Owens got one over on the Chicago crowd on Monday night. Not once, but twice. Those were really the only key things coming out of Raw this past week. That opening segment, I thought, on Monday was fantastic. It was the best thing on the entire show. It's not like it hasn't been done before. We've seen people do this before. We've seen it dozens of times. None better than when Shawn Michaels convinced the crowd, I think they were in Montreal, that Bret Hart was coming out on Raw. That was the week before SummerSlam in 05 when Shawn was about to wrestle Hulk Hogan. And they played Bret's music and everybody leapt to their feet. They went nuts. I remember watching that night and I was excited when they hit the music, and then you realized, 10 or 15 seconds later, motherfucker, and Sean's doing the Bret Hart pose in Canada. How did this man not get murdered that night? It's one of the all-time great moments. So we've seen this done before. This is hardly an original idea. But look, the heat that Shawn Michaels generated in that one segment could keep an entire city warm for an entire winter. But Owens got also tremendous heat from the crowd for coming out, cosplaying as Steve Austin, right down to the bald cap, the knee braces, the jean shorts. Only Steve Austin, I feel like, could make jean shorts work. I mean, I know John Cena had the jorts for so many years. See, the difference is, though, his jean shorts came below the knee. Austin's was above the knee. And somehow he didn't look any less badass when he stomped on down to the ring. Somehow he made it work. But Owens was out there wearing a bald cap, a poorly fitting bald cap. Those people in that building, they wanted to see Austin in the worst way. Chicago is where he wrestled Bret Hart at WrestleMania in the famous submission match, which took place 25 years ago this past week. He's got a lot of fans in Chicago. Not only were they fooled once, Owens fooled him a second time during the segment when the glass shattered again, and he just started smiling. He's like, "You fuckers. What a bunch of morons. He fooled me. Son of a bitch got me that second time." He called for the stagehand, the planted stagehand at ringside, to toss him some of those new Steve Austin lagers. Owens dropped them, so he called the guy into the ring, wanted him to hand it to him, and then he dropped him with a stunner. You know, even though he got me on that second try, as I've said before, it would make no sense for Austin to show up live on, in any of these cities before WrestleMania, because they're promoting a talk show. They're not even promoting a match. They're promoting a talk show. If they were promoting an actual match, they could have popped a big number by advertising a KO show segment for Chicago last Monday. They could have did the KO show on Raw. Owens could have left Austin laying, still would have gotten incredible heat. But this entire feud is built around Austin showing up at WrestleMania, not showing up on Monday Night Raw. Then you've given it away. Them playing the music a couple of times before WrestleMania, that's not a big deal. I mean, that is not in any way going to diminish the insane reaction that music is going to get when they play it in Dallas. I thoroughly enjoyed this segment. And the KO show stuff is the segment I am most looking forward to at WrestleMania next weekend. I'm looking more forward to a talk show segment than I am any single match on a show called WrestleMania. You know, Reigns and Lesnar is going to be good. Edge and AJ Styles is going to be great. But honestly, this is what I am, I think, most excited to see. Seth Rollins still has no official WrestleMania match. It's the John Cena storyline from 4 years ago. Maybe Rollins will buy a ticket like Cena did, and he can sit in the crowd until Cody taps him on the shoulder and says, "Excuse me, sir, you're blocking my view." And then Rollins cold cocks him in the face, and that's how we get to an impromptu match between the two of them. How's that for building to a WrestleMania match? You're blocking my view with your giant pumpkin head. Lots and lots of Cody chants in Chicago whenever Rollins was out in front of the crowd, but there was no Cody Rhodes. So after failing to beat Kevin Owens the week before, this time Rollins confronted AJ Styles. In his first appearance since Edge gave him all those horrific contusions weeks ago, he confronted AJ, he told him to go home to his family, heal up some more, and you can come back after WrestleMania. And I'll take your place against Edge at WrestleMania. Edge and Rollins had three great matches last year. I'm sure a fourth one would be great too. But not at WrestleMania. Adam Pearce and Sonya Deville made the match anyway with the stipulation that if Rollins wins, he would get the spot against Edge at WrestleMania. And the two of them had a very good main event. They went 20 minutes with Edge being the one to cost Rollins his potential Mania match. He attacked Styles with a chair from behind just as AJ was setting up for a phenomenal forearm. That DQ cost Rollins the victory. He snapped after the match. He started throwing furniture around. He overturned the announce desk. He ripped off part of the covers that wrap around the ring posts now. He started screaming bullshit over and over again like he was Bret Hart in 1997. Lots of little Bret Hart tributes this week on WWE and AEW television. I love it. And he yelled at the announcers that there won't be a Monday Night Raw next week unless he gets his WrestleMania moment. Threatening to hold the show hostage. Is that a promise? Don't get my hopes up like that. The only question left is, do they leave the fans heading into WrestleMania thinking that Rollins might really not have anything to do on the card? Or do they spoil the surprise and have Cody either, you know, make an announcement on television, send in a video, you know, announcing the match in advance? At this point, it's so late in the build. I would just save him as a surprise. You know, most people can figure out what's up on their own. Tony Khan didn't say a word publicly when he booked the United Center in Chicago for CM Punk's return. He just called it the first dance. He gave every little hint that he could possibly give without actually saying that CM Punk was going to be there. Without saying, hey, CM Punk is coming back. He's going to be debuting in AEW. But the fans knew. I think most fans are hip to the rumors, and the ones who aren't, the ones who don't live and die on the wrestling sites and the podcasts and all that, they're not going to skip out on WrestleMania this year or cancel their Peacock subscription because Seth Rollins doesn't have a fucking match. So at this point, you may as well save it as a surprise. But what's silly about the Rollins stuff, if you think about this logically, and I know logic doesn't apply on this show, but it's fun sometimes to pretend that it does. Seth Rollins is desperate for a match at WrestleMania, yes? He wants a big match on the biggest show of the year. And while Omos might not be Stone Cold Steve Austin or Edge or anybody like that, he is literally the biggest man they have on their entire roster. And he is undefeated. And it just so happens that last Monday, he challenged anybody who has the balls to step up to him to do so, either on Raw or at WrestleMania. This was after he beat Apollo Crews and Commander Aziz in a handicap match. So would it not make sense for Seth Rollins to try to be the giant slayer and hand Omos his very first singles loss and finally get on the card by challenging him to a match at WrestleMania? I am by no means saying that's the match I want to see. Obviously, they're not doing this because they have a plan for Omos and they have a plan for Seth Rollins. But again, thinking about this logically in kayfabe terms, why wouldn't he at least go to him and say, hey, big man, I have no match at WrestleMania this year. You have no match at WrestleMania this year. I would love to face you at WrestleMania and hand you your very first loss. But he didn't do that. He's still acting as if there's nobody left for him to work with. When the largest man on the roster, the one man you can't possibly miss, you could spot this fucking guy from Mars, is standing right there. And it just makes the whole thing silly. But the latest wrinkle is that Rollins, he posted a screenshot of a text message that he supposedly got from Vince McMahon, saying that somebody from his office is going to be reaching out to you to set up a meeting at the corporate office on Monday morning at 9 a.m. He wants Seth Rollins to be at his office at 9 a.m. first thing Monday morning. So it sounds like Vince is going to choose Cody as Seth's WrestleMania opponent. They may not announce that in advance, but that seems to be the way this is going to play out, that Vince McMahon is going to personally handpick Cody Rhodes to challenge Seth Rollins at WrestleMania. That's my assumption. I think Cody needs to beat Seth at Mania and then have a live face-to-face in the ring with Vince on the Raw after WrestleMania. Worked shoot style. That would be must-see television. Omos, by the way, his post-match promo in there, he talked about anybody who steps to me is going to be dominated. Emphasis on the word dominated there. A not-so-subtle nod towards who his opponent is probably going to be, former WWE champion, Bobby Lashley. Fightful Select reported on Monday that Lashley is the planned opponent for Omos at WrestleMania, and PW Insider is reporting that Lashley is slated to be on Raw in Pittsburgh tomorrow night. So that would be his first appearance since the Elimination Chamber in Saudi Arabia last month. I did think it was odd that Lashley, you know, they said he was going to go see Dr. Andrews last month after the chamber for a diagnosis on his shoulder. And then we never heard another word about it. Usually there's some kind of an update or so-and-so's going in for surgery or if it wasn't so serious, he would have already been back on TV. But there's been no update. Not a single peep. Ever since the mention of him going to see Dr. Andrews. And there was no indication that he had gone under the knife, so obviously it wasn't as badly damaged as they feared. You know, this is the match I predicted for WrestleMania months ago, when it looked like they were starting a babyface turn for Lashley and they might split him away from MVP. I said it's going to be Lashley against Omos at WrestleMania. I said that was a test. What they did on Raw back in September, it was AJ Styles and Omos against Lashley and MVP. When Omos and Lashley tagged into the ring against each other, they did a few spots together. The people were buzzing, got a big reaction. So it looked like we were headed that way, and then Roman got COVID. And everything got changed at day one. Lashley ended up beating Brock Lesnar for the championship of the Royal Rumble. He's still with MVP. They haven't been teasing, well, up to the chamber, they hadn't been teasing any dissension between them like they had started doing. In a match with Omos, though, Lashley is going to be the babyface. Whether he actually turns babyface or not, if that match happens at WrestleMania, we all know who the heel is and we all know who the babyface is going to be. With Bianca Belair out with a storyline throat injury, we got story time with Becky Lynch in the ring on Monday night. This felt like the kind of promo that she should have cut after SummerSlam, if they wanted her to turn heel so badly. This is what we should have heard probably the night after that, or you know, that week on television. She talked about being away for 15 months and coming back to find Bianca to be the chosen one over her. That's when she knew that she would sell her soul for the title, and Bianca damaged Becky's throat, so Becky decided to damage hers even worse. She said Bianca hurt her by accident, but she hurt Bianca on purpose. An eye for an eye, a trote for a trote. It's pretty simple storytelling, but I'll tell you, I am starting to feel the same way about this match that I do the Charlotte Ronda Rousey match. It should feel like a bigger deal to me than it does right now. You know, part of it might just be that Becky missed a few weeks with an injury. Now Bianca's out selling an injury. The story they're telling is that nobody has been able to beat Becky for her championship in 3 years, since WrestleMania 35. Bianca is going to be the one to take that title from her, but it just doesn't feel like as big of a deal as it should. Something, I don't know, something's missing. The big story, though, from Monday night, Veer is coming. I know he's been coming for months. His testicles must be the size of beach balls by now, but he is finally coming. April 4th, the Raw after WrestleMania. Of course, as everybody has pointed out on my timeline, since the announcement was made, they did not specify the year. So it could well be April 4th of 2023 that we see Veer back on television. We don't know. But they've got a real chance. In all seriousness, they have a real chance to push this guy strong after all the hype. It turned into pure comedy, and now the guy is a fucking meme. But if you follow him on social media, he's, you know, leaning into it. He's posted all these images in different places, and, you know, he's got the sunglasses on. He's looking all cool. They could push this guy, and they could potentially have something with him. I have not been watching his matches on Main Event, but if he is any good as a singles wrestler, and if he really shows something, I'm not saying he has to be fucking, he doesn't have to be Will Ospreay or somebody like that in the ring, but if he's more than capable in the ring of carrying his own in a match, then they could have something with him, for real. After all the teasing, and as long as this shit's been going on for, it's turned into a joke, there could be something here. But I know this is WWE, so, you know, even if that's true, they'll find a way to fuck it up somehow. Tomorrow night is the final Raw before WrestleMania. They're dubbing it WrestleMania Raw because they just love whoring out that name. They're advertising Brock Lesnar and Roman Reigns for the show. The Raw Tag Team Champions, RK-Bro, take on the SmackDown Tag Team Champions, the Usos. Why? Fuck if I know, but hey, it should be a good match. The two babyface teams in the women's tag team title match at WrestleMania will meet the two heel teams. Miz takes on Rey Mysterio. This after Miz stole Rey's mask right off his head last week. He said it was a gift for Logan Paul, and he dared Logan to wear Rey's mask on TV. And the Street Profits take on the Alpha Academy. SmackDown on Friday night, as it has been now for weeks, was the Brock Lesnar and Roman Reigns show. Really the only thing on this show worth caring about. Brock was hanging around in Roman's locker room waiting for him to show up. He's wanted to get his hands on him ever since Roman and the Bloodline bloodied him up at Madison Square Garden. So he was there in Brooklyn, hanging out, waiting for him to show up. Roman and Paul Heyman are in their limo on their way to the building saying, if you're there when we get there, we're going to make you bleed in Brooklyn just like we did in Manhattan. Brock, always love a good Brock smash, as he was smashing various items in Roman's dressing room while he waited for him. Ronda Rousey and Charlotte Flair, they had a promo segment to build to their main event at WrestleMania. Still underwhelming. It just doesn't feel like, it doesn't have that WrestleMania main event feel. A lot of it, frankly, has to do with Ronda Rousey and her very wooden, very dull promos that we see on television from her every week. I think the match is going to be very good, but the build to this and Rousey's promos, they've been the fucking cure for insomnia. The Intercontinental and US titles are, as of now, being left off the WrestleMania card this year. There's still time for them to be added at the very last minute. Two nights of WrestleMania, and they can't find room for a United States or Intercontinental Championship match. They're doing the Andre the Giant Memorial Battle Royal again on SmackDown before WrestleMania. They have added Finn Balor and Damian Priest to that match, along with such sterling names as Jinder Mahal, Shanky, R-Truth, Reggie, the Viking Raider, Shelton Benjamin, Cedric Alexander, Akira Tozawa, Mo Larry and Curly. Very sad. See, here's what I would do. Here's what I would do to course correct on this. Damian Priest eliminates Finn Balor to win the Battle Royal. And then he challenges him to a United States Championship match on WrestleMania Sunday. Since they have fewer matches listed for the Sunday show right now than they do the Saturday show, they could do it on Sunday. There you go. And as far as the Intercontinental title goes, Ricochet, he's the number two babyface on SmackDown, right behind Drew McIntyre. He's the Intercontinental Champion. and he lost back-to-back matches on Friday night to each member of Los Lotharios. So now they're doing a triple threat match for the title, not at WrestleMania, but on SmackDown Friday night. Keep in mind, by the way, both nights of WrestleMania, on Saturday and on Sunday, have a two-hour pre-show. So there's a very good chance that we will have a couple of at least a couple between the two nights, a couple more matches added. But as of right now, as of this moment, they can't even find room on the pre-show at WrestleMania. Sami Zayn, he lost the Intercontinental title to Ricochet, but he gets on the WrestleMania card because he's working a celebrity program with Johnny Knoxville. Johnny Knoxville gets on the WrestleMania card, but the Intercontinental Championship does not. There is something seriously wrong with this picture. How does Sheamus not have anything announced for WrestleMania yet? I expect that they're going to throw something together this week, last minute, with him and Ridge Holland, probably against the New Day. But again, I mean, how are they this far behind on stuff with 6 days left to go? How do they not already have a lot of that stuff announced? I guess they feel like it's not necessary because they have their top matches announced. They have the important matches announced. I guess the bottom of the card, you know, it's just not a priority to them. But, it sure would be nice, less than a week away, to have a completed WrestleMania card for this show, if nothing else. Shayna Baszler, she took a hard bump to the back of her head on the floor while taking a cannonball off the apron by Rhea Ripley. There was a four-way match, so hopefully she's okay. Okay for Mania. And they did the show closing angle with Roman Reigns and Brock Lesnar, who never touched. They've kept them apart since the angle at MSG a few weeks ago. This was the best thing on the show. It also got the most heat from the crowd in Brooklyn. As I said at the end of my review on Friday night, after WrestleMania, when this program is over, regardless of who the champion is, this show is in a lot of trouble. Because when there is no more Brock Lesnar, if you presume that Roman Reigns is going to win, let's say there's no more Brock Lesnar on SmackDown. Once Roman has vanquished yet another opponent and they need new baby faces to step up, it's like reaching into the bag of chips and finding nothing but crumbs at the bottom of the bag. They've done a very poor job of prepping the next two or three challengers, potential challengers, for that Universal title. Or whatever unified title, whatever name they're going to give it. Because after Drew McIntyre, who do they even have? That's why I've said for weeks now, I've said, LA Knight, he can't hit that roster soon enough. They could really use a guy like him. WrestleMania predictions I'm going to save. Right now the plan is to go live on Thursday night. We'll do a WrestleMania prediction stream on YouTube. So that is the current plan. Right now, WWE has more tickets out for AT&T Stadium on Saturday for night one than they do for the big Brock Lesnar-Roman Reigns match on night two, the supposed biggest WrestleMania match of all time. They have more tickets sold for Saturday than they do Sunday. They're set up for about 65,000 seats on both nights. Over 60,000 sold for Saturday, about 58,000 for Sunday. I'm sure, when we get to this weekend, it'll probably be 65, I would think, for both nights. But very interesting that Saturday is trending ahead of Sunday. I guess Stone Cold is more of a draw than Brock Lesnar and Roman Reigns are. Two more names have qualified for the North American title ladder match at Stand and Deliver next weekend. Solo Sikoa qualified over Roderick Strong, who is pretty much just there now to put over the newer guys. And Grayson Waller, who got a win over A-Kid on Tuesday's episode of NXT. Carmelo Hayes and Trick Williams, they were ringside to watch it all unfold. Melo has been cool as a cucumber about all of this. I mean, it was his idea to put his title on the line in a multi-man ladder match. He welcomed the challenge. And after A-Kid's loss, they were right there to announce that there's still one spot left to fill in the ladder match, and the person who gets to claim that spot is going to be determined by a second chance qualifier this Tuesday, with all the losers from the previous matches facing off against one another. It'll be A-Kid against Roderick Strong against Cameron Grimes. All the losers get to fight for the right to see who the least loserish is of them all. that man should be and will be Cameron Grimes. He was the only one of the three to get a promo later in the show when they aired a pre-tape with him. He was speaking in his normal voice, not his comedy voice, not trying to be funny, talking about how he feels disappointed that he let his late father down by not having the most success that he could possibly have in NXT. He said he was proud to give his dad the news that he had first signed with NXT. It was the last thing he got to tell him before his father passed away in 2018. I remember that. You know, his father died after his, I think it was the day after his 50th birthday. That was the same day that Brian Christopher passed away, same day that Nikolai Volkov passed away. That was a terrible day. Grimes' father was himself a wrestler. He retired in 93. He had a bad accident. He was also a promoter. He promoted after that, one of the founding fathers of the old Omega promotion with Matt Hardy. So this was a heartfelt promo showing a side of Cameron Grimes that we don't often get to see. He said he's going to make his dad proud. He called the match this Tuesday the most important match of his life. There is no way he loses this match. Roderick Strong is now enhancement talent, basically, and A-Kid is too new to the brand to really matter to anybody. The people are invested in Cameron Grimes, though. And he's the one who is going to win that match and fill that last slot in the ladder match. Tony D'Angelo picked up a win over Dexter Lumis, who has been losing way more matches in the Shawn Michaels era of NXT than he ever did in the Triple H era. Indy Hartwell, who was out there as well, she was in her husband's corner, as was Persia Parada. There's been a lot of tension between the two of them, and that continued here. D'Angelo reached for his trusty crowbar. Indy grabbed it away from him. Persia then took it away from Indy, and when D'Angelo went to grab it back from Persia, they had a tug of war over it. Parada let go of it, and the momentum caused D'Angelo to whack Lumis right in the head with it. The referee somehow didn't see this, and D'Angelo covered him for the win. After the match, as Tony D was cutting a promo on Tommaso Ciampa ahead of their match at Stand and Deliver, here comes Ciampa. His music hits. There's no Ciampa, though. But then he surprised D'Angelo from behind, gave him a fairy tale ending, and said, if this is my last match in NXT, I'm going out on my terms. Electra Lopez picked up a win over Fallon Henley. She still looks rough in there, does Electra Lopez, but that's why she's on the developmental brand, I guess. She is still not ring ready for the main roster. Bron Breakker is challenging Dolph Ziggler for the NXT Championship this weekend, but on this show, he had to go one-on-one with Ziggler's partner, the glorious Bobby Roode, former NXT Champion Bobby Roode, out to his glorious theme music in the robe and everything, not this dirty dog stuff. And it reminded me of just how much I miss the old Bobby Roode. I know he's 44 years old now. He's in the role that he's in. He's never going to be on top, or I'm not saying he should be, but I was a big fan of his heel run as champion in TNA. I was excited when he came to NXT, and it was nice to get a glimpse of that again here. You know, he's sort of there now. He's just there. He exists on the roster, and so you don't really think of him a lot. And so seeing him come out like that with the music and the robe and have what ended up being a really good match, a really good singles match, again, it just reminded me, oh yeah, I forgot about that guy. I forgot about that version of Bobby Roode, that he's still in there somewhere. They don't really use him anymore, but he's still in there. He's still around. And I was reminded of how great he can be in the ring. I will say, where I think they get it right with 2.0, is having their key young guys, and Breakker is at the very top of that list, working with the veterans. I don't need to see Ziggler and Roode and Miz and Rey Mysterio on the show every week, but if they have two or three key top young guys they want to groom for stardom on Raw, stardom on SmackDown, it's never a bad idea to have them in the ring working with main roster talent, and Breakker has excelled so far with everybody they put him in the ring with. He's picked this stuff up faster than most. A little botch here and there, but you know, he doesn't really look out of place. He's got this great intensity about him. You know, when he speaks, same thing on promos, I think that will translate well to the main roster because they don't really have another person like him. He's the kind of person very much like the Steiners, very much like his father, his uncle. He looks like he's cut from a different cloth, from an era that is just bygone. And years ago, you would have found a bunch of people like this, but today you really don't. He really, in some ways, if you're a longtime fan, he feels like a relic from a bygone era. And because there really is none of those people left anymore, he stands out. Ziggler was ejected from ringside early. We got that trademark Bobby Roode spinebuster. He countered a gorilla press by Breaker into a glorious DDT for a glorious near fall. In the end, Breaker caught him with a power slam coming off the middle rope. After the match, as Breaker was leaving, Ziggler came back out, dropped him with a super kick. Breaker is the real deal. And Roode, much like Ziggler, I think was a great person for him to work with. Walter was the star of the show this week. Or I should say his hand was. He destroyed Duke Hudson in what was more or less a squash match. And there were multiple brutal chops that he delivered, but there was one chop in particular that popped the entire building and got a holy shit chant. How often does a single knife-edged chop garner a chant of holy shit? Not very fucking often, but it did on this show, not unless your name is Walter or Gunther. Oh my God, he chopped the soul out of this man. And the reaction it got was my favorite thing on the entire show. It's not often I rewind the show back, but I rewound that part. I watched it back three times. It was so great. After he pinned Hudson, whose chest was just beat red and bleeding when this was over, Walter cut a promo on LA Knight, who, if you recall, confronted him in the locker room last week, made fun of Walter for being a charisma vacuum. Knight came out to confront him, and after taking a shot at Walter, Imperium swarmed him, until MSK ran out to make the save. Later on, they made it official for stand and deliver. It will be Walter one-on-one against LA Knight. And I would not be surprised to see a six-man tag on television this week with MSK teaming up with LA Knight against Imperium. But nothing has been announced yet. As I am sitting here recording this, nothing has been announced. And in the main event, Io Shirai and Kaylee Ray defeated Wendy Chu and Dakota Kai to win the 2022 Women's Dusty Rhodes Tag Team Classic. There was nothing classic about either of the tournaments this year. I don't know what they're doing with Dakota Kai, but she is completely lost on this show. Io won it for her team with the moonsault press on Chu. I mean, this hardly felt like the finals of a major tournament. I mean, it was fine, but it's not anything that I think most people are going to remember 2 weeks from now. After the match, all three members of Toxic Attraction, they got into the ring. Mandy Rose was warning the winners that they are going to be beaten by Gigi Dolin and JC Jane, because the winners of the Dusty Cup typically go on to challenge for the tag team titles. That's the whole point of it being a tag team tournament. I mean, that's how this thing works. Or at least that's how it used to work. Io and Kaylee Ray both talked about having their sights on Mandy's title. And Kaylee Ray announced that at Stand and Deliver, the NXT Women's Championship match between Mandy and Cora Jade, because there was already a match announced. Kaylee Ray announced that match is now going to be a fatal four-way. Excuse me? So instead of fighting for the tag team belts, they apparently have the power to forego their shot and instead insert themselves into the women's championship match. Even the announcers seemed perplexed by this. Cora Jade rushed out to the ring to attack Mandy, and there was a brawl to close out the show. So a few things to unpack here. I am not going to completely drag WWE for the logic here, because I have a feeling. And this, I have not seen this reported anywhere. I'm not saying this is the case as a matter of fact. But I have a feeling that Gigi Dolin may be hurt. She may be nursing some kind of an injury. It could be a minor thing. There was fan video from the PC that was uploaded by someone named Rich of that brawl at the end of the show. And if you watch it from his perspective of filming it, while everybody is brawling, and by the way, you know, watching this video, it really, it's jarring to see, because we don't get to see that hard camera side where the camera is when we watch NXT. So we see the little arena they've built and, right, you know, they have the screens and everything. We don't get to see what's on the other side, which is nothing. It's a fucking wall. So This person is filming this in the crowd, and I'm looking at nothing but like just a blank wall in the background. That it just, I don't know, it was kind of jarring to see that. But as this brawl is going on, if you watch it, everybody's brawling, and Gigi Dolin, very cautiously, she exits the ring on the other side. Never touches anybody, never does anything physical, very calmly and casually walks out of the ring. If there is an injury, then it would make sense that they would feel the need to call an audible and make a late change. If there's an injury, I can't fault WWE for that. The way they went about it was very silly, but if there was a late injury that ruined their plans and they knew they couldn't book a women's tag team title match, then making the Mandy match a four-way is the best option to go with. It does make the women's tag team belts feel completely worthless. You know, that the two of them would voluntarily forego them to go after a different belt. But Io and Kaylee Ray, you got to remember, they're singles wrestlers. They're not a real tag team. They were a tag team of convenience for this one tournament. Kaylee Ray is a singles wrestler. Io Shirai is a singles wrestler. So they should want to go after the women's championship if you really think about it. The other reason I'm not going to shit on this too much is because it improves the card for Stand and Deliver. It shaves off the extra match, which just wasn't needed. I think six matches is more than enough. And Cora Jade is not ready for that spot. Cora Jade against Mandy Rose on paper sounded like a mess waiting to happen. The match now is going to be a lot better as a four-way with Io and Kaylee Ray in there than it would have been without them. So I think it's a change for the better. Now, speaking of Stand and Deliver, let's run through the card. I will give my predictions. I do plan on going live on YouTube after the show ends, even though it's the same day as WrestleMania. WrestleMania Saturday is April 2nd. I'm sorry, is it April 2nd? April 2nd. They're doing the Stand and Deliver show at 1 o'clock Eastern that afternoon, the same day. So I will review the NXT show as soon as it ends. And I will try to get the hell out of there as quickly as possible, because then I got to prep for the WrestleMania stream later that night. So that's going to be a very busy day. This is going to be the first NXT show of the 2.0 era to take place outside the Performance Center. Show takes place at the American Airlines Arena in Dallas. They are set up for over 5,000 fans. Right now they have over 3,700 tickets out for the show. I find that shocking, to be honest. With all the fans that are going to be in town for Mania, they haven't moved more than that. I think that's very surprising. I think that's disappointing. We have Walter, one-on-one against LA Knight. I mean, this should be a no-brainer here. LA Knight should be on Raw or SmackDown, probably SmackDown. And Walter is being built up. He should be, you know, in the process of being groomed for an eventual championship match with Bron Breakker. So this is a win for Walter. Call him Walter, call him Gunter, call him whatever you want to. Call him Winner. Tommaso Ciampa, and what they're teasing could very well be his final match for the NXT brand, takes on Tony D'Angelo. D'Angelo lost his weaponized steel cage match to Pete Dunne last month at Vengeance Day, only for Pete Dunne to then get called up to SmackDown as Butch. I can't see them having him lose to another NXT original in back-to-back feuds. Especially if Ciampa is wrapping up and possibly being called up. That would be two people in a row who beat D'Angelo and then left. What sense does that make? You do the honors on the way out of the territory. That's how it works. And as far as Ciampa, look, if this is the end of his run with NXT, he's done all that there is to do there. So I'm picking D'Angelo for the win. I think he has shown that he's more than capable in the ring, so I think this will be a good match. Imperium defends their NXT tag team titles against MSK and the Creed brothers. I think if they give them enough time, this could steal the show. The match that the Creeds had with MSK in the Dusty Cup finals felt too short, like it was just about to kick into that next gear when all of a sudden it just ended. It was less than 10 minutes. Hopefully that doesn't happen again here. I think the Creeds are going to get it this time. I think they're going to bring the gold home to Diamond Mine. Carmelo Hayes puts his North American gold on the line in a five-man ladder match against Santos Escobar, Grayson Waller, Solo Sikoa, and the winner of the last chance qualifier this Tuesday, which is going to be Cameron Grimes. And I think Cameron Grimes not only qualifies, but he goes all the way. I'm picking him to win the North American Championship. He's going to do it for Dad. Mandy Rose defends her NXT Women's Championship in a fatal four-way against Cora Jade, Io Shirai, and Kaylee Ray. I feel like Io and Kaylee Ray sort of cancel each other out. And also, if they had to make a late change because of an injury, then, you know, I don't think that it's in the plans, or it was in the plans, for them to put that title on either one of them. So I don't see either of them winning, and I think it's way too soon for Cora Jade. I think having all the extra bodies in the ring gives them an out to have Mandy steal the win and retain her title. In fact, I could see her literally stealing the pin off of somebody else to get the job done. But regardless, I think the title stays with Toxic Attraction. And Bron Breakker challenges Dolph Ziggler for the NXT Championship. Ziggler is there for one reason and one reason only, and that is to drop the belt back to Bron Breakker. Unless Bron Breakker is getting called up to the main roster the week after WrestleMania. And I'm not so sure that wouldn't be a terrible idea. But unless that's happening, then he needs to regain the title. I mean, there's no question how this match is going to go. There is next to no chance, next to no chance, that Dolph Ziggler beats him and then closes out the show as the NXT champion. There's no way. Breakker regains the title, which is what this is designed to do. It's designed to give him a big win in front of the biggest 2.0 crowd to date. Whether there's 3,700, 4,700, 5,700, whatever it is, it's going to be the biggest 2.0 audience yet. After he wins, there's lots of names who could conceivably challenge him for the championship next. Carmelo Hayes, you know, if Hayes does drop the title, his North American title on this show, then he could go on to challenge for the NXT title. And the name I suggested a few weeks ago, Walter. But it might be best to hold off on that a few months and not take the belt off Breakker so soon after he wins it back. So the Walter match, I would put some distance between that. But Bron Breakker is going to regain the NXT championship. So join me immediately after Stand and Deliver on Saturday. I'll be live with a recap on what is going to be an absolutely insane weekend that I will talk more about what the schedule is going to be, but I have one last thing I want to do. I got one last piece of business to transact with all of you before we leave this week. There is a new series on Peacock called WWE Evil, which is a series of hour-long documentaries narrated by John Cena, focusing on different wrestlers and their turns to the dark side and what makes them a great heel. They dropped all the episodes at once, so they're all on demand if you want to watch them. They start with Hollywood Hulk Hogan, and then they have episodes for The Miz, Sasha Banks, The Brothers of Destruction, Randy Orton, Stephanie McMahon, Ric Flair, and Roman Reigns. You probably saw the Randy Orton clip floating around social media this week where he talks about how he gets into that zone, he lets all the blood, you know, he kind of leans over and lets the blood flow to the front of his face, and then he starts smacking himself. That's how he gets himself psyched up when he's in heel mode, heel viper mode. I probably should have started with that. That looked interesting. But I started with the Hogan one, since that was the first episode. So that's what I wanted to review here real quick, is the Hollywood Hogan episode. They interviewed a bunch of talking heads for it, including Hogan himself. Eric Bischoff was all over this thing. Jimmy Hart was all over this thing. Kevin Nash, DDP, Booker T, Shawn Michaels had a brief little comment that he made. Bruce Pritchard, Vince Russo. Yes, they covered the Bash at the Beach incident. They stuck Peter Rosenberg in there. They had a brief comment from David Shoemaker. But they also had Mario Lopez, and they had Dr. Phil, and they had Corey Taylor from Slipknot, who talked about what it was like to be a young wrestling fan when Hogan turned heel. Forget that for a second. We had Dr. fucking Phil analyzing the psyche of a wrestling heel. We had a huckster talking about the Hulkster. I'm not sure who the bigger worker is. Is it Dr. Phil or is it Hulk Hogan? If you are a hardcore wrestling fan, you're not going to learn anything new here. It is a lot of the same recycled stories you've heard before with some exaggerations thrown in.
I think this is something a lapsed fan would really enjoy. Someone who maybe doesn't watch wrestling anymore, they don't follow it as closely as they used to, but they live through that era. They live through that Monday Night War, NWO period. Some of the backstage stuff they would probably hear about for the first time watching this. You know, like WCW not having a third man. When Scott Hall went out there, I think it was the Great American Bash, and he said, you know, we're going to have a third man. You find three guys, we'll have our third man. They didn't have one. They hadn't confirmed yet who the third guy was going to be. And they talked about how Sting was the backup choice after Bischoff initially pitched the idea to Hogan of going heel, and Hogan basically said, get the fuck out of my trailer. or his house, wherever they were. I think it was in his house. Hogan didn't want to hear it. Because even though his popularity, you know, with some of the crowds may have been waning and there were more boos and stuff, he still got a lot of cheers. He still sold a lot of merch. And he didn't want to do it. So Sting was going to be the backup choice. Then Hogan probably realized, wait a minute. They're going to go with Sting here and give him the big push. Wait just a minute here. Yeah, he had a change of heart all of a sudden. He thought about it some more. The way that they, and again, this is where they took creative license with some of this stuff, in terms of the timeline and everything. I think the way they sort of presented it was, Hogan initially wasn't really interested, but the crowds, they then realized, were starting to turn against the Hulkster. And as he saw this happening and playing out in real time, that's kind of when he realized, wait a minute, brother. You know, we might have to go a different way with this. Timeline is a little off here, but that is more or less what happened. Crowds were booing Hogan long before Eric Bischoff came up with this whole concept. I mean, that had started, I think, the year before. And actually, they had tinkered with the idea of a Hogan heel turn, where Hogan came out, he was dressed in all black, just like he was as Hollywood Hogan. That happened almost a year before he even turned. They didn't talk about that. They didn't talk about his trip to the dark side in late 95. That wasn't addressed here. But they did talk about Bash at the Beach, and, you know, they talked about Hulk changing his mind and agreeing to turn heel, which, no exaggeration, the biggest thing in the world, if you were a wrestling fan, the biggest thing in the world at that time, when it happened, was Hulk Hogan turning heel and joining the NWO. And we see Hogan dropping the leg on Randy Savage. You know, it was one of those rare, truly shocking, game-changing moments. We hear about moving the needle and changing the game, right? These are words that are thrown around, that I think they're thrown around so much they don't really mean hardly anything anymore. You want to see a truly shocking, game-changing moment. You watch Hulk Hogan walk down to that ring at Bash at the Beach while Bobby Heenan wonders whose side is he on, and then he drops the leg on the Macho Man. That turned out to be the mother of all game-changing moments for WCW. It talked about Hogan's creative control clause in WCW, and Kevin Nash recounted the "That Don't Work For Me, Brother" story, which is always great. But that wasn't even the best part. The best part of that, talking about creative control and everything, was listening to Hogan talk about how everybody else's ego was raging out of control. How the inmates were running the asylum, brother. I mean, you know, he was just minding his own business, Hogan was, with his creative control. He said all of this with a straight face, by the way. I am at the point, though, and I reached this point a long time ago, when I hear Hogan talk about certain things, and in some cases just flat out fucking lie through his teeth and tell tall tales, I truly don't know. I truly don't. If he just makes shit up and knows that he's full of shit, or if a lot of that stuff, he has said it for so long that he now believes it, and he has blurred the lines of fantasy and reality, and he actually believes a lot of the shit that comes out of his mouth. I truly don't know. I don't know where Terry Bollea ends and the worker Hulk Hogan begins. I think they're just one and the same at this point. They position Hogan against The Rock at WrestleMania 18 as a passing of the torch deal, which is weird given how big of a star Rock already was. I mean, the man had already headlined the previous three WrestleManias. He headlined WrestleMania 15. He headlined WrestleMania 16. He headlined WrestleMania 17. But now, he's never touched Hogan before in his life. But this is going to be the passing of the torch. There was no torch for Hogan to pass by that point. And I absolutely love that match. It's one of my all-time favorite matches, but it's the typical WWE version of how they tell these stories. The Bash at the Beach deal with Russo is addressed. They told a portion of the story. They left out a lot of details. They also tried... They presented it as Hogan not knowing that Jeff Jarrett was going to lay down for him in the first match when he put his foot on Jarrett's chest and pinned him for the title. The way they presented this... Again, if you didn't know any better, if you were a new fan or a lapsed fan or whatever, you would watch this and think, wow, Hogan didn't know that Jarrett was going to lay down for him. Which is not true. That part of it was planned all along. It was Russo coming out later on and shooting on Hogan that Hogan wasn't expecting, and that's what led to the lawsuit and him leaving WCW. You know, they went through all that before ending with the NWO coming to WWE, the Hogan Rock stuff, and then the turn right back immediately after WrestleMania from, you know, the black to the red and yellow. And that's how they ended the episode. Look, it's fun to go back and relive some of these big moments, but as documentaries go, I mean, this was very basic, very standard stuff. Hogan is the only man, though, to have been such a transformative figure as both a babyface and a heel. He basically had two different careers, and in both cases, he brought two different companies, the two biggest promotions in the country, maybe in the world, at the time, to heights that they had never reached before. And he did it with Vince McMahon's vision behind him and the WWF marketing machine behind him, but they latched onto Hogan as their superstar in the mid-80s, and they launched themselves national just into the stratosphere on the back of Hulkamania. And then you turn around 10 years later, a decade later, you fast forward, and Hogan did it all over again, this time as the bad guy, working for WCW under Eric Bischoff's vision. He did it again. He took WCW, or had a very big part in taking WCW from the number two to the number one promotion. Who else can say that they've done that? Who else can say that they have had like these two different careers and two totally different roles that just uplifted their respective companies, I mean, in the way that Hogan was able to do it? Whether you like the guy or not, there is nobody else who can say they did what Hogan did. And that's something that nobody could ever take away from him. So anyway, I might check out more of these. I'm hoping they're a little bit better than this one. But again, they're all up right now on Peacock. If it sounds like something, I do think you should check out, you know, at least some of them. I mean, they're well produced. But again, if you're looking to learn new stuff from the Hogan one and, you know, get the truth on all of these stories, the whole truth and nothing but the truth, then you're looking in the wrong place. I am going to have a very busy week. I'm hoping that you will join me for it, because the beginning of this crazy week starts on Wednesday with the AEW Dynamite stream. I'll be live on YouTube after Dynamite. The very next night, the plan right now is to go live Thursday for WrestleMania predictions. I'll give you mine. You can give me yours. You can hang out. The SmackDown stream will be on Friday night. That might include a Hall of Fame recap. I'm not sure, because now I'm seeing that the Hall of Fame might be a 90-minute thing starting at 10:30, which means it wouldn't even go off the air until midnight. So I'm not entirely sure exactly what I'm reviewing beyond SmackDown. If you know, I decide to go with Rampage or watch the Hall of Fame, we'll figure it all out. But I'll be live one way or the other. I'll be live on Friday night. And Saturday, you're going to get two streams. Stand and Deliver comes first in the afternoon, and then WrestleMania Night 1, as soon as that show comes to a close. Sunday, I will have to find time to record episode 750 of the podcast, whatever that looks like. And then the WrestleMania Night 2 review will be on Sunday night to cap off the entire weekend. So busy, busy, busy. I hope you enjoy all the content and you'll join me for it all. Again, I'll be back with you for episode 750 of the podcast next Sunday. So until then, be well, stay safe. If you are traveling to Dallas and you're going to any number of shows that are going on there, have fun. I had a blast, in Dallas years ago for WrestleMania 32. In fact, I remember the morning after WrestleMania, the one and only live edition of the Sound Off from Frankie's downtown in Dallas. We packed it. We packed that place. We had almost 200 people, I think, packed in down there in that bar. It was me and Noah and Brian. We had a great time. I got to meet a lot of cool people. And I'll see you back here for all the content, starting Wednesday night on YouTube with Dynamite, right on through WrestleMania Night 2. Until then, take care, guys.
The Salamonsters Sounds Off.
Funny you bring up LA Knight. You know, LA Knight is a guy who I've spoken very highly of. Would he not be somebody that you think they could use right now on SmackDown? He's not one of their younger guys. Why is he not helping them now when they need the help? I thought developmental and NXT was building for the future. Why is a guy like that still down there? Well, you have this guy who's pretty damn good, has charisma for days, and could help you right now. So why not get him on up? It boggles the mind.
The Salamonster Sounds Off. Each week, bursting with content. Podcasts, predictions, reviews, YouTube live streams, and more. Become a channel member for perks and follow the Salamonster on Twitter at Salamonster.
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 Salamonster Sounds Off.